I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to worship at the altar of music and comedy. The giddiness and the harmony of a well-crafted comedy song brings great joy in abundance. Join the tinkling talents of David Thames and me, Phil Nickel. Sit back, turn it up, and enjoy Songs in the Key of Laugh.
Yes, this is Songs in the Key of Laugh with me, Phil Nickel.
And me, David Timms.
A little comedy podcast that celebrates comedy songs, comedy songwriters, and musical comedians.
Absolutely. Now, Phil, I have to say I am extra excited about today's episode.
Get out of town. Why is that, dude?
I mean, we have today one of my all-time heroes.
Oh, my God. Adam Whittaker is on the show?
Actually, we couldn't get Anne this week. No, but we do have the amazing Tim Minchin.
What?
Why am I saying what?
I already knew that we had Tim Minchin because we spoke to him.
We did. Yeah, you were there.
Yeah, we did actually. And he's fantastic. That's going to come up later in the show.
It is, absolutely.
Before we do that, though, we're going to have our comedy song contest submissions.
We are. Yeah,
we've got a great one this week.
We do. It's a parody this week.
A political parody.
Absolutely. And we will also have our quickfire parody.
It's not just a political parody. It's a Welsh political parody.
Is it Welsh?
Yeah, it's Welsh.
Is it?
It is.
Oh.
And we have a quickfire parody game.
And we do as well, yeah.
And you do really well on it.
Do I?
I don't know. We haven't done it yet. But I'm assuming you will.
I was going to say, mind you, after last week's, I think I've just about bought it back.
Yes. I don't think so.
Thanks.
What was my last week? I threw a bun at you.
I threw a bun at you.
I'm so sorry, everyone. Anyway, thanks for listening. The guys that are listening, people that are coming back and listening, thanks for joining us on this podcast. It means a lot to us. We have a Patreon, patreon.com/... Songs in the Key of Laugh, if you want to help us out, keep this podcast going, because we talked to people like Tim Minchin, who Tim got into a big thing about Bo Burnham. And
he did.
And I would love to get Bo Burnham, if you're listening, Bo, come on the show. Come on the show, Bo.
Much less likely to come on now.
Why? I even sang to him.
If anybody here knows Bo Burnham, please do ask him to come and join our show. Have you?
I know Bo Burnham. I met him in Edinburgh. I don't think he'd remember me.
Oh, well, yeah. Okay. Can you slide into his DMs?
Yeah, sure.
Is that a thing you can
do? I'll ring him up. But first, let's listen to a little bit of Tim Minchin.
Okay.
I don't know what you just asked me, because I stopped listening after I realised the headline's going to be Minchin captures children. I mean, we live in a world where decontextualisation is clickbait, and I just don't think I can continue with this podcast.
Well, we're going to come back to the Tim Minchin interview at the end of the show, so stick around for that. It's worth waiting. You could always skip ahead, I suppose, if you want, but... Don't.
Oh.
Now, I was thinking about, Tim mentioned Bo Burnham and sort of influences and things that influence. A lot of our show is about that. And I started thinking about the influence I had. Now, you know that I was raised in a kind of devoutly Christian family.
Yeah.
And we weren't really allowed to listen to a lot of secular music. So my comedy influences, I didn't have the normal comedy influences, although we were allowed to listen to Billy Connolly because my family are from Scotland. I don't know how he slipped through the net. We weren't allowed to listen to The Biggin, you know, the Scottish Jesus sketch, because that was blasphemy and
sacrilege.
But I remember going up to our cottage. We used to play, sing songs all the way up, and hymns and things. But this was one of the songs that went like this. If it wasn't for your wellies, where would you be? You'd be in the hospital or infirmary, cause you'd probably have a dose of the flu or even pleurisy if you didn't have your feet in your wellies. Wellies are wonderful, wellies are swell, cause they keep out the water and they keep out the smell. When you're sitting in a room, you can always tell when some bugger takes off his wellies. If it wasn't for your wellies, where would you be? You'd be in the hospital or infirmary, cause you probably have a dose of the flu or even pleurisy, if you didn't put your feet in your wellies.
Oh, Phil, that's beautiful.
I know, that song was written by George McEwen.
Oh.
Like a lot of the earlier comedy songs were kind of like political, had like a political edge to them. I mean, the songs were sung in working men's clubs and music halls and stuff like that. Like that Welly Boots song has lines in it about fishermen and firemen and farmers and the country grinding to a halt and all that stuff. And
yes, no, you're completely right. It's like My Old Man. Do you know that song?
My Old Man's a Dustman.
I meant the other one, but my old man's a dustman. He wears a dustman's hat. He wears called blimey trousers, and he lives in a council flat. He looks at proper nana with his great big hobnail boots. He had such a drop to pull them up, but he calls them daisy roots.
Whoa, oy! Have a banana.
Well, where does that come from?
What?
Have a banana.
No idea.
We should look into that.
So what is the My Old Man song that you're talking about?
Yeah, so it's, do you know Don't Dilly Dally on the Way?
No,
I don't. Very musical, yes.
Was that Sly and the Family Stone?
I think not. No, no, but My Old Man, it's an old music hall song, and it tells a story of a family that's having to move house. Because right. They can't pay the rent anymore.
Okay.
But a lot of the time in music hall, they will like speak, sing a verse. Mm. And then when they get to the chorus, then everybody will join in and hilarity will ensue.
Absolutely.
And everyone will roll about laughing. So this is the song. We had to move away because the rent we couldn't pay. The moving van came round just after dark. There was me and my old man shoving things inside the van, which we'd often done before, let me remark. We packed all that we could pack in the van, and that's a fact. We got inside all we could get inside. Then we packed all we could pack on the tailboard at the back, and there wasn't any room for me to ride. Oh, my old man said, follow the van and don't dilly-dally on the way. Off went the cart with me own packed in it. I walked behind with me old cot linnet. I dillied, I dallied, dallied and I dillied. Lost the van and don't know where to roam. I stopped on the way to have an old half quartern, and I can't find my way home.
Oh, have a banana. What's a quartern?
A quartern, it's a drink.
Yeah, I'm assuming it's a lot to drink.
Hmm. Now, Phil, it is apology time.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Well, for what?
Well, you know, since the beginning of this podcast,
yes.
In fact, I think since that first walk we went on, that fateful walk where I fell over.
In the mud.
In the mud, yeah, that one.
Really fun.
you've been telling me about a particular artist.
Yes.
Of whom I only did a very, very little bit of research on.
Yeah, okay.
But when we then had Tim Minchin on the show. When we had Tim on the show, he, which you're going to hear later on,
yeah.
He told me more about this person.
Right.
And so because he did, I then did my research.
Oh, no. Okay, I got it.
Okay, and that man is Bo Burnham.
Bo Burnham. Yeah, of course. It's obviously Bo Burnham. I've been saying from the beginning, if we're going to do a podcast about comedy songs and musical comedians, you can't really get past Bo Burnham.
No, you're right.
And I'm surprised that you as a musician actually don't know him either, because the guy's had over 500 million hits on YouTube. I think he might be one of the most important musical influences, if not comedy musical influences, musical influences in the last 20 years or so. I mean, all the kids know who he is. He's one of a kind. He's the most unique artist, I think, or especially comedy musical artist or artist in general. He is sui generis. Not Ellen DeGeneres. No, he's sui generis. No, he's not Ellen DeGeneres.
He's
Bo Burnham.
Welcome to the internet. Have a look around. Anything that brain of yours can think of can be found. We've got mountains of content, some better, some worse. If none of it's of interest to you, you'd be the first.
Yeah, I could listen to that. That's just a fantastic track.
It's so good. So please do go and listen to that track. And
I'm so glad that it was finally brought to your attention by Tim Minchin.
Yeah. Thanks, Tim. But he's got a special on Netflix, hasn't he?
Yeah, I've already said that.
Have you?
Yeah.
Oh.
Inside.
Inside. Huh.
There is a lot of new comedy songwriting talent out there. I mean, Bo Burnham started writing songs when he was 16. So we thought we'd try and support that with this podcast by starting the Songs in the Key of Laugh Comedy Song Contest.
Contest?
No, it's a contest, David.
Okay, it's a contest.
Our entry from this week is by a guy called Matt Lewis. He's Welsh. It's a parody, but it's a political parody. It's a Welsh political parody called Matt Hancock, Stop Masturbating.
If you're really fucking sick and fed up with the politics, you met me at the perfect time. I don't care, I have my say, Hancock, you have had your day, so I went and wrote this rhyme. Boris even said, you have made your bed, used it such a fucking job. I'm not gonna listen to your words of repetition, you're a liar and a two-faced knob. You've lost it, you evil prick. Your cheating ways, they make me sick. No more lies, you're full of shit. Yeah, 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 yeah. Now you're in spotlight or kissing in daylight with Gina, you gobshite. Why can't you follow rules? Stop masturbating, Hancock, you're out of time. I'll shove your rules with sunshine. We're fucking glad that you've resigned. I hope your wife's okay, you need castrating. Yeah. Every day he mentions stress, problems with the NHS, hospitals overrun. How can he so easily say don't hug your family, but he can have his bit of fun? Smirk upon his face, doesn't seem to care, his interviews make me cringe. You should be saving lives because that's what you're paid to do instead of going after Minge. You little creep, so full of shit, one word for you, that's hypocrite. Go and suck on Gina's tits, yeah, 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 yeah. Now you're in spotlight, court kissing in daylight with Gina, you gobshite. Why can't you follow rules? Stop masturbating, Hancock, you're out of time. I'll shove your rules where sun don't shine. We're fucking glad that you've resigned. I hope your wife's okay, you need castrating, yeah. I wonder how much money he siphoned out of the NHS, the little fucker. He will ruin lots of lives tonight. He will ruin lots of lives tonight. He will then take us for a ride. I'm Secretary of Health, Matt Hancock. And to save your lives, I really work my ass off. Yeah, all I seem to do is talk bollocks. Like, yeah, 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 yeah. Boris Johnson really fucking hates me. Everything I do, he just slates me. He told the Queen that he underrates me. Yeah, 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 yeah. You've lost it, you evil prick. Your cheating ways, they make me sick. Keep your lies, you're full of shit. And the UK is over it. Now you're in spotlight, court kissing in daylight with Gina, you gobshite. Why can't you follow rules? Stop masturbating. You will ruin lots of lives tonight. You will ruin lots of lives tonight. You will then take us for a ride. Motherfucker. You will ruin lots of lives tonight. You will ruin lots of lives tonight. You will then take us for a ride. No more. Now you're in spotlight, court kissing in daylight with Gina, you gobshite. Why can't you follow rules? Stop masturbating, Hancock, you're out of time. I'll shove your rules with sun don't shine. We're fucking glad that you've resigned. I hope your wife's okay. You need castrating, yeah. And I'll do it myself.
Well, there you go. That is a very political parody, which I think brings us quite nicely to our next segment.
We're gonna get given a song we know and have to change it up and make it so hysterical that you win the cup. This game is really easy, just follow all the rules. The rules are really simple, you're not allowed to lose.
It's the quickfire parody game, and if you don't know the rules are, or what happens is, I give David the name of an artist, and he gives me the name of an artist, and I give him the name of a song, and he gives me the name of a song, and I'm gonna give you Elton John. Just to begin with, because you remind me of a young Elton John.
Why?
Yep,
I don't look like Elton John.
Okay, Billy Joel. You remind me of a...
I don't look like Billy Joel either.
Neil Young?
I don't look anything like Neil Young.
Okay, it's Elton John, and the song is Candle in the Wind.
So Candle in the Wind.
It's quick fire. quick fire parody game. It's Candle in the Wind by Elton John. Can you parody that song, David? You know the song.
Yeah. And it seems to me you lived your life as a shambles full of gin. Yeah? Never being as successful as your older twin. I'm glad that I don't know you, because you smell really bad. You're a shambles and you know you are. Just heard that from your dad.
No, the shambles and you know you are. I think I can beat that one.
I think so.
Quick fire parody game.
Okay, Phil. Are going to parody me.
Am I?
Yes.
Okay.
The song Rave On by Buddy Holly.
Buddy Holly's Rave On.
You know it?
Yeah, of course. Okay. I love playing that song.
Buddy Holly, Rave On.
Rave on.
Quick fire parody game.
Okay. Here we go. The little things you say and do don't affect the beard you grew. Shave on, it's a crazy feeling, cause I feel your cheeks are reeling when you say, I won't shave, oh, shave on with me. Shave on, it's a crazy feeling now. I see your cheeks are reeling and your soul face is revealing to me. Oh, shave on and show me what you can't grow me. shave on me.
Shave.
Right. Well played, Phil.
Quick fire parody game.
Do you write comedy songs?
Ever dream of being the next Tim Minchin?
Or being Tim Minchin?
That's weird.
Yeah.
Why not enter our Songs in the Key of Laugh comedy song competition and maybe appear on our podcast?
With Tim Minchin.
That's better.
The Songs in the Key of Laugh comedy song competition. Enter today. Visit songsinthekeyoflaugh.com for details. It is a little bit embarrassing that we mentioned Tim Minchin in the commercial and now we've got him on the podcast.
Only slightly embarrassing.
More for you than me. Why is that, David?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to lie. I'm quite a huge fan.
David likes Tim Minchin.
Yeah, I do. He's sensational. He was such a pleasure to interview.
This is a great interview.
So here you go. It's Tim Minchin.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The guest on today's show is someone you might know. And if you don't, that's your own fault. But you'll know them soon.
You know you will.
This jingle has been personalized for a guest that we hope that you recognize. And this week their name is...
Insert name here.
Tim Minchin. It's Tim Minchin, guys. Let me tell you a little bit about Tim Minchin. He's an Olivier Award winner. He's a Tony Award winner. He's an actor. He's a cabaret star. He wrote Matilda, Groundhog Day. I mean... when I think of musical comedians, I'll be honest with you guys, he was the first person on our list of people we needed to speak to. Welcome, Tim Minchin. Hi, Tim. How are you?
Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Was that too much? Did I give you a big American buildup? You've probably seen him on NBC's. I mean,
it's only just enough. I thought you should just...
So Tim, it's been we're talking to you from Sydney, Australia, and it's been a bit mad in Australia this lockdown. Yeah. Has that affected your creativity? Have you become more creative, less creative? How have you dealt with it?
I haven't felt the fatigue really, because a lot of I stopped touring for years, so I haven't really. Like, not touring is not a big deal for me, and sitting in this room and writing is pretty normal. I mean, definitely there's lots about it that's different, and the lack of socializing and, the lack of gigs, but it doesn't really bother me. And one of the great joys of my career is that I do get to go, right, I'm going to write a song for this film, and now I'm going to write a script for TV, and then I'm going to do some voiceover acting for an animated thing, and then I'm going to... And it's... I don't get stuck in a rut. I have plenty of stuff to take my attention if I get a little bit stale on one thing.
That's wonderful. It's great that you're so so wonderfully versatile.
That's what I was trying to say. I would have said I'm really wonderfully versatile, but you're not allowed to say that anymore.
No, but I am.
It's not cool.
I'm really, really keen to ask you about how you come about writing, just in general. I've MD'd productions of Matilda before, and it's amazing. And the way that you capture the children so well, and their emotions through these songs is so beautiful. How do you put yourself into that mindset? How do you write a show like Matilda?
I don't know what you just asked me, because I stopped listening after I realized the headline's going to be Minchin captures children. I mean, we live in a world where decontextualization is clickbait, and I just don't think I can continue with this podcast. I'm stoked that you've MD'd it, and the score is beautiful, largely because of Chris Nightingale, who is the orchestrator and did all the weaving of my themes through the piece. But I got asked recently, because Matilda's heading to its 10-year anniversary on the West End, and so I'm doing a bit of press around it, and I got asked just yesterday in an interview about, did I have to sort of recall my own childhood to try and tap into a thing? And I don't know. And David, you and Phil, all you guys would have your own process and stuff, but I don't feel like writing from another character's point of view is so much a sort of meditative, like trying to put yourself in that state. It doesn't feel like something I have to reach for. I don't have a lot of clear memories of my childhood. I don't feel particularly connected to my childhood self, but the notion of childishness feels very local to me. Doesn't feel... I feel like that's not a tough job. And for me, especially because I was so into Roald Dahl as a kid and Quentin Blake's illustrations and stuff, the idea of like, what does the music for that feel like is quite a visceral. It's like, oh, it feels a bit like this, it's a bit waltzy and it's a bit circusy and it's a bit angular and it's a bit, chromatic. And so it's not a very intellectual exercise. It's more a sort of just a response in a different language, I suppose.
Your background's come out of sort of cabaret comedy songs and sort of shorter form songs, looking for like when we write songs, when I write a song, I'll get a premise for it, and then I'll just sort of start churning out rhyming couplets, and then you look for a little story in it, and then you try and find a twist at the end. And there's like sort of little rules that we use to write what writes a good cabaret song. There are just rules that work for them, with the big flourish at the end. Da 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 is the joke where you end the song with da 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 da. But when you've moved on to writing these longer pieces, I mean, it's the next generation. That's something that I've not been able to get myself to, writing to the next generation, of where you've got to keep a story, a long story going. And do you think your early work with like Dark Side and the earlier pieces that you did and all the fun little, I don't want to call them silly, but it is just silliness. Do you think that informed your later writing?
Well, there's two sort of edits I'll make to your premise. One is I come from theatre. So I wrote my first score for theatre when I was 17.
Oh, wow.
I wrote 10 songs for a musical version of Love's Labour's Lost. In the year I turned 18, the following year I did a I did a youth theatre company version of Mother Courage, and they thought that the pre-existing score was not right, so I rewrote that score, and I wrote four or five scores for Shakespeare's during uni. And so I'd written 10, 12. So that's where I come from. And I always wrote quirky songs. So that's that. That's my real background. Comedy was a diversion or a digression. The other thing is, although I definitely wrote ditty, like comedy songs, even right back in Dark Side, you know, there was Peace Anthem for Palestine, the We Don't Eat Pigs, You Don't Eat Pigs song, and Inflatable You, which is, you know, exactly as you say, all the rhyming couplets and a little bit of a twist. But there was also fully fledged in that show, I had Not Perfect, which is a total storytelling ballad that has no jokes in it. Just has quirk. And Rock and Roll Nerd and Dark Side itself were really pop songs.
Yeah.
And in the year after Dark Side, I wrote a musical about a rural Australian town called Penrith. And the year before Dark Side, I'd done a bunch of music for a documentary about the Singapore Zoo. And, you know, so there's a...
Yeah.
I guess...
I'm a theatre kid as well, and I... but I'd sort of like a sloppy guitar player who started playing the guitar because I was the guy that could play a few chords in the theater group, not because I'm a musician as, you know, at the same level that you are. And it's interesting to know that you've had those. So you started playing piano when you were younger?
I started at sort of 9 or 10, and I did 3 or 4 years, and then I quit. So I'm not trained really, and I went and did a music course after I did my arts degree, after I did all my English. You know, I'm much more of a theatre nerd in the sense that give me a Shakespeare text and I can analyse the fuck out of it for you. You know, I went and did what was called a commercial music course, which was, you know, teaching you to play in different styles, sort of trying to put out session musos really. But because I couldn't read or write music, I thought I've got to go to uni because I seem to have a knack for this writing for theatre thing, but I'm going to hit the ceiling, you know. They're going to want me to read dots. And so I went to uni to try and learn, but I was way too far gone. But what I did learn is Logic, the program, back when it was just MIDI. But that allowed me to write demos and churn out shitty digitally generated charts that were good enough to allow me to keep composing. And then, of course, that technology got better. And then this thing happened where suddenly I was a person who could have a Chris Nightingale, who could have an orchestrator. Wow.
That's amazing. So so not writing out the dots yourself and playing them into Logic, is that's how you came about composing the music for, for Matilda or for...
Yeah, so Matilda, like a lot of it, like there are bits in Matilda that Chris really orchestrated, but something like the overture, the opening number, Miracle, which is 8 minutes long and complete chaos, is very similar to what I put into Logic. So all those ba-da-ba-ba-da-da-da flute lines and all the weird angular bass lines, and it's all me. If you really get into piano, unlike guitar, which you can get good at guitar without really understanding harmony, really understanding theory. Like, I don't think Hendrix really understood theory. He was just a bona fide genius. Mm. Whereas if you play piano, you can't get very far without understanding it, because you can't just move your hand up the fret. You have to understand that an octave goes tone, tone, semitone, tone, 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 semitone. And you have to understand that an extended major chord is a major 7, is a major 9, is a major 9 sharp 11. And the more you know, the more you inherit technically. So my theory is pretty good. So when you say I can't read or write, people are like, you play by ear, and you're like, no. It's like, imagine knowing all the plays of Shakespeare. You understand the text, you understand the iambic pentameter, you understand enjambment, and you understand the different ways you can interpret it. It's just that if you were asked to write the words down, you wouldn't be able to write the words down.
Yeah,
it's more like that.
I know so many musicians who are very, very similar to you. I play with a bassist who plays with Amy Winehouse, and he's not a reader. So the other day I got him to jump in on a gig with us, and he said, oh, do I have to read? I was like, no, just use your ear. And so he turned up, I gave him a load of charts. He was like, no, it's fine, I don't need those. And yeah, just the whole entire gig is just by his ear. He's amazing. Phenomenal. He's great. But that
Whereas
is
I
so
can't
many
do that
musicians do that.
Because when I say I can't read or write, I can read chords. And without a chord chart, I'm pretty
yeah,
screwed.
I have to have these things in front of me. My ear's good, but I have to have these charts in front of me to make sure that I'm going to be, you know, at no point am I going to be completely out of my depth and going...
It's easy when you're a bass player. Just...
I'll tell him you said that.
Yeah. Well, I mean... It's not something I get completely lost. I remember doing a gig at the Jazz Cafe, and it was comedy and jazz on a Sunday night. So the full jazz band, and there was all the comedy fans there to see Corky the Juice Pigs, and then all the jazz fans that were just there regularly. And at the end of the show, we stormed it. We had this great gig, and that you walk up the stairs and around the balcony. As I was walking on the balcony, they came on and went, let's get the guitar player back and jam with the band. I was like, no, I play omitted thirds, and people started chanting, and I was like, no, it's okay, but, and so I had to go back down, and I plugged my guitar in, and he's going, it's B flat, and I'm like, where is B flat? Like, I'm looking at my guitar, going, I'm not even sure, but I go, it's in, if it's F, then okay, B flat, okay, I finally got the B flat, and I'm just playing, they go, that's it, and they're off on their thing, and I'm sitting there going, I don't even know what 12 bars is, man. I'm just like, so I turn my back to the audience, not realizing that's the coolest thing you can do at jazz.
And yes, just right? A couple of tasty notes. This is taste, man. It's
this
all
is
taste.
Hit a note.
That
once
one was
a while,
deliberately
right?
Dissonant. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And then I'm playing my omitted thirds, you know, like just with the two fingers. And I'm just sitting there going, "This is." And then they go, and they look over, and they go, "Okay, drum solo." So the drummer goes off, and we all stop, and I'm like, "Oh no, there's going to be a solo."
Then you don't know where one is, and you're like, "I don't know where one is anymore."
I don't
know where the harmony is. I don't know where the melody is, and now I don't know where time is. Thanks a fucking lot, guys.
I have no idea.
This is jazz. Now
yeah.
I feel what jazz is.
This is what jazz is, right? And then they all come back in, and I come back in with them, so I'm pretty good. But I'm playing quieter and quieter and quieter, not realizing that out front the sound guy is turning my guitar up louder and louder and louder. So he goes, and he looks over at me. And I'm like, I shake my head, no, I don't want to go. He's like, okay. And then he goes, go to the bass player. And I'm going, oh no, this is absolutely hell. And he goes, bow, back in again, we're back in again. And I'm playing quieter. And I'm just like going, I'm just like looking at the floor. He looks at me. I'm like, no, I can't go. He goes, okay. So he takes the solo. And I'm thinking, oh, you leave the best solo for last. That's how it works, right? And I'm just absolute rubbish. And then the sound guy's, I'm playing so quietly now, the sound guy's got me up full. So when it comes to finally my solo, I don't know what to do. And I'm thinking, do what Phil Nickel would do. It's jazz, they'll follow you. So I just started going like, da na 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 na, like a Mark Bolan-esque sort of like, just as loud. And it and because it was so quiet, as soon as you turned my guitar up, it was so loud, the crowd went, blah! It was like, ah! And they just, all the guys in the band looked up, and within two notes, they were all in on playing like rock blues.
Straight eights.
All of them, straight in. Straight in. Like they went, oh, this is what he's doing, bam, bam. And it just, and I was like, no solo. And it was just, and I just, you know, how that fake riffing
just
I do.
Out.
Where I pretend to play. So absolutely terrifying not to have a clue.
It's worse being me because I think I can play jazz. And whenever I'm on stage with a jazz band, I'm always drunk. It's always late night at some jazz gig. Everyone's like, get up. And I'm like, whatever. Like, fuck.
Yeah,
I can't play. I can play all right at home, but I can't play jazz. I can't swing under pressure, man.
Also, a 12-bar blues is absolutely fine. You can do a 12-bar blues absolutely anywhere. But then you go to a venue and they're playing a 12-bar blues in it, and they're doing it as jazzy as they possibly can. You're like, these are not the chords that we learned 12-bar blues. Even if you've got 6-2-5-1s popping in, it's still not the same thing. But there was also, there's an amazing solo on site. It's Muddy Waters, and he's playing alongside another guitarist. And this young guitarist goes completely and utterly crazy, does the most phenomenal solo you've ever seen, and Muddy Waters is sitting there, he's like, and he just plays one note for his whole 48 bar solo. He's like, so you could have done that as well, Phil. It could have been.
Well, I saw a thing recently, Jacob Collier, who's just an unbelievable genius. It's Jacob Collier and Herbie Hancock, and Jacob Collier, they're going solos back and forth. If you've watched the video, Google it's worth watching. Jacob, and you can see Herbie Hancock just going, man, this guy is great, he looks impressed. Then it comes over to Herbie Hancock, and he just comes in on the note, on one note, dun, 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 and then he just goes, and you can see Jacob Collier's mouth drops going, oh my god, that's what I wish I had done, to have the calm to go, I can't really do better than that, I'm going to do the opposite and start at the lowest thing. And it's just this magical
I saw a jazzer in Melbourne recently, and he's really good pianist, and this young saxophonist got up, in a floppy hat. It was all hat, no trousers, he's like like he had this horn, and it was all like smoking a vape, I suppose. And he kind of got up, and you could tell he'd learnt that lesson, He was super cool to look at, and he cruises up. He's all skinny, and he starts the couple of tasty notes, man. And you're like, yeah, tasty. That's cool, The kid's only like 24, and he's starting super chill, just a couple of tasty notes, and then like 8 bars later, you're like, oh, he's got fucking nothing. He's got no chops. Like, you're like, cool. He's all look. He's all hat. He's all skinny. He's all tasty notes in the first 8 bars. And then he tries to open it up, and it's just like, oh, my God, it's terrible. Why did they get those, student saxophonist, work experience night? It was really funny because he really sold it until he started trying to play. That's me. I'm that guy.
You don't hold back. You must be a fairly centered person. Is that something you've always had? Is that been a motivation for you, or have you found the platform of your music allows you to say those things?
It's the second one, I think. I certainly didn't become a comedian or an artist to push an agenda. And I think if anything, my activism in inverted commas has, in this binary world, has allowed people to make assumptions about my politics. And obviously you can make assumption about my politics because I'm largely progressive and small l liberal, and I believe in climate science, so I must be a lefty. But I'm a data head, I'm a super pretty nerdy about science, and if I have any body of knowledge other than a vague understanding of harmony, it's logical philosophy and stuff like that. So I was struggling, I was writing music for theatre and trying to be an actor, and got rejected by every agency in the country, and couldn't get, I was sort of doing auditions and didn't get anywhere, and I had an original band that I couldn't get any traction with that. I was sort of playing cover bands. There's absolutely no sneering whatsoever. My wedding band and cover band time was joyous, and I was incredibly lucky to have those gigs. But, when I started doing this cabaret thing, when I started going, right, I'm just going to take everything I'm good at and throw it on stage at the same time. So I'm going to write quirky songs, and I'll do little sketches, and, I'm an all right actor, and I'm all right pianist, I'm all right lyricist. People were laughing a lot more than I thought they would. I thought, this is quirky, but it was comedy, right? And at the same time, I had my general interest in psychology and philosophy sort of, had led me to reading more. There was a book by an author called Francis Ween called How Mumbo Jumbo Ruined the World, which actually probably reads pretty, in this binary age, he'd be he'd be a Jordan Peterson, you know, but at the time we weren't dividing things so clearly down the middle. It was a bit of an agitating book about politics overcoming data, basically. And that sent me down a rabbit hole, and eventually it led me to, you know, it intersected with New Atheism and Hitchens and Dawkins and Harris and Dennett and all those white boys. And I guess I was, my reading was just taking me into those areas where I was feeling very frustrated about how bad people are at thinking, or the ways in which people are bad at thinking, including myself, humans. And at the same time, I was starting to get an audience. And when I went, oh, I've got crazy hair and eyeliner and I play a piano pretty well, and by the way, I'm going to lecture you on post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacies of causation and correlation, people fucking came to my show. And I thought, all right, I'm that guy. I'm a nerdy, preachy, logic music guy. And that's what I built my career on. And the audiences started coming so fast that I needed to write. And so I wrote. And, yeah, that taught me that polemic is an interesting form. And I got good at polemic. And so I wrote Storm, which had a big impact. And then, yeah, when I was feeling pissed off at Australia's most powerful Catholic for burying sex crimes, I thought, cunt needs a tune. And I guess but to your question, I'm not centered. I find two things. I find the backlash incredibly difficult. Not that I don't think I deserve it. You give it, you got to take it. But, you know, my very specific criticism of a particular moral act elicited dozens of newspaper columns calling me a hypocritical, Catholic-hating, lefty, stoner, faggot, whatever, you know, and not in the newspaper but on the internet. And I find that's always hard. No, you'd have to be a psychopath not to find that hard. And I'm not, as I say, it's part of it. The other thing is I've spent a lot of time thinking about whether that's moral, given that in general I don't believe in public shaming. I don't think public shaming is the mechanism for moral good that everyone on the left is pretending it is. I think it's probably a terrible thing in general because it dehumanizes people we disagree with. And so I want to know what my role is in that. I'm like, well, hold on, I'm anti-public shaming and yet I eviscerated this man in using an art form that's sort of almost unfair fighting in the public sphere. Now I can launch a really good defense of that act, but I don't just go, yeah, fuck him. I've thought about it a lot, you know.
I don't think you are wrong, but I understand why Catholics and people who want to defend their whole belief system would not be able to see that, and that is part of
the
human.
Yeah, and your point is very apt in that there's two different things going on here. One is self-analysis and holding oneself to account. Just because you've done something doesn't mean it's right. And that basically is the human condition. We're like, well, I did it, it must be right, and now I'm going to firm up my defenses and make sure no one ever criticizes me. Just because you did it doesn't mean it's right. Just because you are passionate doesn't mean it's right. Just because you feel it keenly doesn't mean you're on the right side of history.
Yeah.
Hello, fellow lefties.
But also... Yeah, go ahead.
On the other side, sorry, Phil, to back up your point using too many words, on the other side, just because you get a bunch of hate doesn't mean you're wrong. So this is, as an artist or a public figure, these are hard to unpack because you've also got your own little broken self-esteem and all your own fucking shit you're dealing with, and you're trying to discern between legitimate self-criticism, legitimate external criticism, legitimate self-defense and ignoring the criticism. You know, fuck, how do you unpack it?
Yeah, I mean, we're living in a world where that is becoming more and more, because we have so much information and easy contact with one another. We are all of us, and I include, especially like the young people in my family, are becoming expert ninjas at batting away criticisms. And it has another effect. It has the opposite effect. Sometimes people then don't accept any criticism.
Exactly. Are we the last generation to take that shit seriously? Like, well, I have been really knocked sideways for days, weeks, months by hate. And I wonder if part of it is because I really take it to heart and I consider whether they might be right. And when you're considering whether a bunch of people calling you a fucking imbecile might be right, that's psychically very difficult. The next generation just like inoculated against that by exposure from a young age. Haters gonna hate. It's like, well, that's a great catchphrase and I'm glad you're protected against it, but sometimes you're the one being the dick, you know?
Yeah, well, I take other people's criticism upon myself. So if I'm sitting in a room full of people and people are having a bitch about someone, I go, oh, did you hear what fucking Tim mentioned? I was thinking, that could be me they're talking about. Maybe it is me they're talking about. Maybe I do that. Do I do that? I do that. And then I can somehow convince myself and I go, and that is something I find really hard to shake off. I can't be alone in that way of thinking. And
well, Phil, not to just have a circle jerk, but, you know, I spent 8 years in the UK and had the extraordinary experience of having a career take off quickly. And I can name on two hands the people who are just kind. And, you know, despite the fact we all feel competitive and it is a competitive atmosphere. You know, this character flaw of yours has made you an incredibly kind and supportive person,
desperate.
And, you know, so it might hurt you and it might be tiring, but I'd rather you had that flaw than the flaw where you're chippy bitch about everything all the time.
Well, the
comedy scene.
I mean, you're also
he says being a chippy bitch.
Yeah. Let's talk about people we hate.
Yeah, that's right.
Tim and Phil, can I ask, how do you guys know each other?
We don't know.
I mean,
it's literally Gilda Balloon 2005, isn't it?
I don't know, really.
And then we ended up living, you know, three streets away from each other for years.
Well, we had a drunken conversation, Tim, in the Haringey Arms, which eventually I then got carted off by my friend Chelsea, who just won a match, and he walked in and went, oh, you're Tim Minchin, Dave, come outside.
I was just telling you about how much I hate Chelsea.
This conversation.
A bunch of talk.
No, I was talking to you about, I was writing a show for kids that we were taking up to Edinburgh, and I was like, right, okay, what an amazing opportunity this conversation could be.
I remember this conversation. I can't believe you've left it till the middle of the podcast to tell me that was you.
Do you remember it? Seriously, Tim, are you winding us up?
No, I do.
It was a few years ago, but I've done loads of stuff with youth theatres over the years.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think even at that time, I think we just started doing When I Grow Up with BSL, which I don't know if you've ever seen BSL versions of Matilda, but it's stunning. It's so, so beautiful. And having kids on both sides of the stage doing When I Grow Up, and they go, When I Grow Up, When I Grow Up, When I Grow Up. And I know that you can't see me because this is a podcast.
Well, I can, though. That's so great. I mean, I've seen it translated into various sign languages over the years, but I don't think I've seen a whole choir doing it. I might have.
I tell you what, when the next time we do it, I'll send it over so you can have a look at it.
Please.
It's beautiful.
That's awesome.
It's so pretty.
And go Chelsea. Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm a United fan. I just did not want that in any way, shape or form. But
who are your comedy songs? Since it's a comedy song podcast, are you influenced by comedy songs, or tell me about your...
I don't think I really was. I wasn't really into comedy. I'm not a comedy guy. One of the great joys of ending up in comedy in the UK is I got to meet and love all these comedians, but I only ever really watched the comedians that I got to know as people first. I was like, oh, I wonder what they do. And, you know, Stuart Lee and Tony Law and Sean Locke, bless him, and, you know, all those, and Watson and Key and Horn and all those boys... I got to love them as people and saw their comedy and I got to love their comedy, but I'm not a comedy guy and I'm not a musical comedy guy. I think my influences, I've always loved people who use lyrics playfully. And I grew up listening to the Kinks and Beatles and Queen, and you know, and they all, you know, Kinks, half their songs were basically what you would call comedy, you know, were what they call novelty songs in America. Mm. I have got to meet people that I can't believe I'm meeting. And what I've learned about that, like wanting to meet people, is for them to want to meet you. That's what you want.
Mm. I mean, yes.
You know, and so I've been really lucky in that, like for me, it's, I've had dinner with Tom Stoppard a couple of times because I've got to know him a bit, and I've had a few drinks with Steve Sondheim, and obviously a couple of boozy lunches with old man Lloyd Webber before he stopped drinking, and I've had dinner at Ian McEwan's house, and I've had dinner with Zadie Smith, and like these, this is what matters. You know, I've also had dinner at Sandy Bullock's house and Tom Cruise's house. No, I haven't been to Tom Cruise's house, but I met these people, but that's not what freaks me out. It's having dinner with Ian McEwan and Zadie Smith that I write it down, and I write the date, and I go, never forget that you got that joyous thing to sit with authors and playwrights and people who actually reflect the world. And, you know, I've had dinner with Dawkins and, you know, friends with Brian Cox. I'm very, very – I'm just dropping names now, but I'm very enamored by big brains, not so much things I've been a fan of in a cultural sense, but minds that I admire and aspire to try and I would love to be able to articulate ideas like some of those people.
Yeah,
I know I've listed a lot of men there. I don't know what to say about that.
No, I mean, that was the question, and you're not dropping names because I did ask you.
I had a good chat with McCartney once about songwriting.
Did not have a chat with McCartney about songwriting.
Okay, now you're dropping names.
That is amazing.
There's dropping names to gain my respect, and then there's actually you're allowing yourself to remind yourself of how great that life is. And by saying it out loud, sometimes when I start to feel a little bit bad about what I've achieved, or I've not achieved enough, or I'm not doing enough, and I feel unmotivated and start to get depressed, I have to literally verbalize all the great things I'm doing. So even this morning, I woke up just in a bit of a mood. I'd been to see, launched a comedy festival in Brighton yesterday, and seen the film premiere of Everybody's Talking About Jamie, and woke up today feeling depressed. And I was like, what is wrong with you? Mm. And then I realized I'm going to be interviewing Tim Minchin, who's not only just a friend of mine, but you know, you are one of the most renowned songwriters of our era. So, I mean, if you can't,
that's why you are depressed. I go talk to that name dropping fuck.
No, it's because I feel like you've achieved so much, and it's an absolute blessing to everyone here. I hate using that word, but it's a gift to all of us that we have you as a creative person. I don't want to take much more of your time. We've asked all of our guests if they would mind performing something for us, and we kind of left it open to the guests if what they'd like to perform. So it's like a little bit of a live performance.
I mean, you know, I'm a retired musical comedian. I don't play any of that shit anymore. So I could play something old.
Sorry. Wait, you don't play any of that shit anymore. What, my whole lifestyle choice?
Yeah, your whole life.
You don't do that shit anymore.
You've
become a quite
serious actor, you know. There's a...
You don't want to be seen as someone that's messing around anymore, do you?
Well, I don't know. I saw Bo Burnham, you know, like I love Bo.
Yeah.
He's the musical comedian. I think he's just so much better than anyone in the world.
It's amazing.
As a satirist, it depends what you want from your musical comedy, obviously. We talk about it as if it's one thing. Bo is just, I mean, I remember when I first met him when he was a kid, I'm just like, yeah, this kid's going to wipe the floor with all our fucking faces. You know, he's just the smartest guy I know, really.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I haven't really kept up with, you know, musical comedians, except that I'm a huge Bo fan. And that's made me want to just retire completely.
Well, I was actually going to bring up Bo Burnham, and then we sort of left it behind because that when that show came out, it made me feel like I just don't have the skills. It was so brilliantly put together. And I watched it two nights in a row because I think you can't just watch it once.
No,
and then you start realizing his music's being used as backdrop music on like TikToks and all the kids, the amount of effect that's had on kids and the joy involved and the social comment. I wondered if it inspired you to do anything because you sort of sit in a category of people I think that could do something that's with that scope.
Well, it made me wonder whether I've made the right decision because I, after Matilda, and I basically decided I wanted to be taken seriously as an artist, basically, and it took me till I was about my mid-30s to believe I could be. And then once I got that belief in my head, after Matilda, I thought, hold on, if I can be a composer, lyricist and a writer and an actor, then I want to do that, you know. And it was a bit about proving to myself that I could be taken to, you know, could have the audacity to think of myself as an artist.
Mm.
As distinct, and also just because comedies, as I say, it's not. I didn't grow up aspiring to it. Bo was a massive comedy fan, but I just think you need to let yourself move through the phases of your life, you know. And I definitely, when I watch Bo, I think, shit, like he is brilliant, and I'll never be Bo, but. There's no doubt I could make something like that, but I didn't, right? And art is always about what you choose to do. And what I chose to do during lockdown is I did a live stream of my first serious album. And it was not even in the same universe success-wise, but it's something I've been trying to do for 25 years. So, you know, that's my decision. And also I have co-written a TV show that I got to act in, and it's sort of the best thing I've ever done, I think. And it would be a sad indictment on my personality if, having got all that satisfaction out of doing that, I looked back over my shoulder at the kid who I was his, Beau was a fan of mine back in the day. Mm. I was, you know, if I looked back at that kid and went, oh, I should be doing that like that kid, that. I thought, come on, Tim, fucking get your hand off it, you know.
I actually once I got over the jealousy, I found myself completely inspired to try a little harder or to be just do follow your muse a little bit more. But when you did your album stream, how did you feel? Did you enjoy that? Like, when you were finished, was it satisfying?
Yeah, I'm proud of that record. I don't know who it's for, but I don't worry too much about that. I'm just very, very lucky. I still have all the competitiveness and jealousy that artists tend to have, but I got bigger problems, you know. Like, I got my own shit. Mm. And on the other hand, I wrote Matilda, so I don't have to worry too much about the bills. So the distraction of whether or not I'm doing the thing I should be doing is some way down the list, you know.
Right, got you.
I'll play you a little intimate version of my plane crash song, which has some good lines in it, but it's a bit wistful. That's so cool.
Okay, is that going to make people sit through that at your funeral?
Yeah,
eight hours of songs about me.
It happened. I told you it was going to happen. You didn't believe me. I told you I was sick.
He didn't look well, to be honest. Yeah. So,
sorry, that great was... photo of a. I think it's a photo of probably apocryphally a photo of a tombstone in Ireland that says, "I told you I was sick."
It's Spike Milligan's.
Oh, is it Spike? There you go.
There you go.
All right, I'll put some reverb on you bitches, so I don't sound so shit.
be more of a cliche. 30,000 feet above Nebraska, scratching lyrics on a napkin, praying that this turbulence will spare my wine. The plane is almost empty, but for 320 other humans, all staking their existence on a couple of dozen rivets, straining between fuselage and wing. A fact we're only coping with by drinking. If this plane goes down, I hope that I'm one of the cool ones. Will I have the nerve to play the clown? If this plane goes down, if this plane goes down, remember me as someone who tried to find a balance between self-loathing and pride. Dug too hard for love at times. So if it ends in flames and fuel, please tell my kids I kept my cool. If my time is up and this plane goes down, if this plane goes down as we hit the ground, I wanna be smiling happily, Hades bound. If this plane goes down, if this plane goes down, remember me as someone who cared often but not always about his hair. Self-righteous when shit wasn't fair. So if it ends in fire and glass, please tell my kids I went down classy. If my time is up and this plane goes down, I've no regrets as such, it's just a shame I've so much still to do. If my youth was wasted on me, I don't care, 'cause I wasted it with you, my love. And from up above this planet looking down, the world reduced to greens and browns, toy trains in paper mache towns. And just for now, the trials of humankind dissolved by altitude and wine. I really think that I'd be fine if my time is up and this plane goes down. If this plane goes down, I hope that I can get people laughing. Will I have the balls to tote around? If this plane goes down, if this plane goes down, remember me as someone who went down with fair results but grand intent, found his meaning in how phrases can be bent to the will. Where will my remains be sent to be eventually, dentally identified? So if this flight should end in tears, please tell my kids I've felt no fear, and tell them that there's smoke well clear, and tell them that he didn't spill a drop of beer. If my time is up and this plane, if my time is up and this plane goes down.
Goodbye, adios, farewell. You'll be glad to hear that we think that your interview went well. But we have other things to get on with now, so you're gonna have to go. I'm sure our paths will cross again, but whoever really knows? It's been fun, it's been musical, it's been comical at times. But now we have to leave you, so goodbye, goodbye.
You're listening to Songs in the Key of Laugh with me, Phil Nichol.
And me, David Timms.
And I thought it was a pretty great show today, to be honest. If you enjoyed the show, Songs in the Key of Laugh, please share this podcast with your friends and family. Let them know that we're here.
Absolutely. It doesn't mean anything if there's nobody listening to it. So no. Please do tell your friends. It's amazing that we've had so many submissions and so many beautiful messages from people to our email.
Yes.
So thank you so, so much for sending those in. And we're going to continue to play those amazing comedy songs in our contest.
Songsinthekeyoflaugh@gmail.com. If you'd like to see Tim Minchin on tour in his 2021 Encore tour entitled Back, then visit timminchin.com for details. He's in the UK until January 12th.
Fantastic. Please do keep on sending us in your comedy songs for the Songs in the Key of Laugh comedy song competition.
If you want to support our podcast, why not join us at patreon.com/songsinthekeyoflaugh and give us some money, or coffee.com/songsinthekeyoflaugh.
I've been David Timms.
I've been Phil Nichol, and this is
Songs in the Key of Laugh.
Songs in the Key of Laugh.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.